listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from around Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. We spoke with him via Skype late Monday. Okay, so we have a lot of ground to cover this week. Let's start with Cuba's president returning from Asia.
I think that's a very significant visit by Díaz-Canel, not just in terms of Cuba, but in terms of the broader region, and in particular the Alba countries. Because Díaz-Canel would normally have participated in the meeting of the Alba Countries Political Council, although it's normally only the foreign ministers that take part. It was quite a significant date for, in terms of the relationships between the different Alba countries. And I wouldn't have been at all surprised that if Díaz-Canel hadn't had those previous commitments, that he'd have turned up in Managua for the meeting of the Alba Political Council. And the why do I think the two things are related? I think there are several things that were interrelated over the last few days. The fact that Díaz-Canel visited Russia, North Korea, China, Laos, and Vietnam is very very significant, because although I don't see it as just the president of Cuba renewing and consolidating very well established long-term relationships that Cuba has had with those countries, all led by progressive regimes back in the days of the Soviet Union, and all have come to terms with this what have we had now ever since the end of the Soviet Union? What is it? That's almost 30 years of savage capitalism.
Yeah.
And those countries, Vietnam, Laos, North Korea, China and Russia, have all in their very different ways come to terms with a world that from 1990 onwards was pretty much a unipolar world dominated by the United States and its vassal states in the European Union.
Yeah, and for Cuba and North Korea, it was particularly savage. We're talking the special period, quote-unquote, in Cuba, for example.
Yeah, and all the difficulties to do with famine and the reasons around all that. The isolation of North Korea during that time as well.
Both. I mean, the U.S. thought that all they had to do basically was starve those two countries and then blow on them and they'd fall over after they swung China and Russia, you know, the USSR fell apart.
Right. So this visit by the president of Cuba, one has to understand that he represents a new generation in terms of Cuba's revolutionary leadership. And so it was really important for him to go as Cuba's head of state and do these state visits to all these long-standing traditional allies of the Cuban Revolution.
Yep.
Because although the Russian Federation, of course, is no longer the Soviet Union, in terms of its foreign policy has actually changed very little from what I can see.
Yeah.
The foreign policy of the Soviet Union. That's quite logical.
Yeah.
Because the situation of the Soviet Union vis-a-vis the West is almost identical to the current situation of the Russian Federation.
Right. There might be. Anyway, they might not have the ideological competition that existed before, if you want to frame it that way, but. You know, the Russian government still maintains sovereignty over the Russian landmass, which, of course, has all these riches and this highly educated population on it that the people who own most of the rest of the world think is theirs. And so that government is, you know, finds itself in the crosshairs of, you know, Western militaries and Western geopolitics and such, just like the Soviet Union did for exactly those same reasons, pretty much.
Yeah, and whatever the differences that those countries, North Korea, and obviously has its differences with in within that region with China and other countries, and
right.
But the fundamental thing is that they all believe in defending national sovereignty, a multipolar world, respectful relations between peoples without intervention or interference in internal affairs. All those fundamental principles of international relations, those countries defend very much to the disgust of the ruling Western elites. So that was important, but what I'm trying to get across is that it wasn't Díaz-Canel didn't do that just as the president of Cuba. He also did it very much as a representative of the ALBA countries. And I was listening to something by a guy called Uriel Sanchez, a Cuban a journalist who runs a program called La Pupila Insomne. And he was interviewed on Telesur the other day, and he said something very interesting, which was that whatever one thinks about the current right-wing offensive driven by the United States' desire to recolonize Latin America and the Caribbean, if you look at ALBA now compared to when it happened, when it started back in 2004, when Fidel Castro and President Hugo Chavez Frias decided to initiate what was then the Bolivarian alternative of the Americas, which now the Bolivarian alliance of our peoples of the Americas. It was just Cuba and Venezuela. And now, after, what is it, almost 15 years of ALBA being in operation, although Honduras joined and was then left as a result of the coup.
Right.
And although Ecuador has retired from it as a result of the betrayal by
Right. Yeah.
Lenin Moreno of the ideals of the citizen revolution of Rafael Correa. Yeah. And you still have a bloc that is much stronger than it was back in 2004.
Right.
And that, right. That I think that fundamental point is well worth bearing in mind when you look at the massive propaganda about, you know, the end of the progressive cycle, all that stuff that people write to kind of make it look as though progressive ideas have lost popularity or have lost relevance in some way.
Right.
In Latin America and the Caribbean. And so there are lots of things that I want to look at in precisely in relation to that. But the first thing is that when President Díaz-Canel did his tour of North Korea, Vietnam, Laos, China and Russia, he was not doing it just as the president of Cuba. He was doing it as a representative of the ALBA bloc.
Right.
Although that might not have been explicit, de facto it was the case. And so what he's doing is consolidating relationships that Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela has already done a tremendous amount to develop over the last couple of years as a direct result of U.S. Led sanctions and also sanctions from U.S. vassal states in the European Union. And so one kind of underlying theme to what we're talking about, that what this area that we're looking at, is the way that U.S. sanctions actually are entirely counterproductive because they drive people to find alternatives to the previous system that the U.S. dominated.
I mean, we're seeing evidence of that all over the Díaz-Canel's trip. You know, discussing military cooperation with Russia and China. Okay, Russia and China are now declared strategic partners directly as a result of the U.S. moving against both of them during the Obama administration, simultaneously sanctioning Russia, attempting to mess with its economy, threatening China militarily and economically. They now, you know, see themselves basically in a forced marriage by circumstances. And, you know, Cuba, of course, you have the whole history of, and even the economic problems that still exist there are a direct consequence of the U.S. sanctions and that again got voted down almost unanimously at the United Nations General Assembly. But that still exists. I mean, these countries have no other choice but to do this because of the U.S. policy towards them.
Right. And so when you look at that, you have Díaz-Canel involved in that very important visit, consolidating longstanding relationships. You have Nicolas Maduro, he's visited both Russia and China this year, as I understand
right. It.
And so he is also involved in consolidating those relationships. And then, this may sound silly, but last week, the president of tiny El Salvador was on a state visit to China.
Right.
That's relevant in terms of the United States has been trying to wrap El Salvador and Panama over the knuckles for abandoning Taiwan and opting to open up relations with China. And so now you have the president of a small Central American country, President Seren, opening up relations with China, goes to China for a state visit, and is treated as, you know, a respected. He's not treated like, you know, he wasn't given 5 minutes with the president.
Right.
You know, which is what would happen to him in Washington. Right.
If.
And although the protocol may be all flummery in many ways, it does signal something. And what it signals in this case is that China takes seriously its avowal that it respects other countries, no matter how big or small they are.
That's right.
And so President Seren was able to, there were no dramatic announcements, slight increases in support from China. But the important thing is that El Salvador And the reason it's important in this context that we're talking about is that El Salvador is kind of a member of ALBA. It's not a full member of ALBA, but it participates actively in Petrocaribe and other ALBA programs. And so, again, you have a national state, El Salvador, very closely associated with ALBA, going to China and consolidating that relationship with China.
Right.
Now, that's not as high profile a deal as President Díaz-Canel or President Maduro going to visit China or Russia, but it's still an indication that I think of these things in terms of ratchets. So it's another little ratchet down in the leverage that the United States has in the region.
Yep.
And it can kind of huff and puff as much as it likes, but if you look at we've had this conversation, this theme in our conversation many times.
Absolutely.
The presidents from the region go to Washington, explain their problems to Washington, and Washington tells them, drop dead.
Right.
They go to China, and that's what happened with Manuel Zelaya. Manuel Zelaya went to President Bush back in the days, in the last year, I think, of President Bush's presidency, or was it 2006, something like that? And he asked for assistance with the Honduran economy, and George Bush told him to drop dead, in effect.
Right.
You know, and so where did he then go? He joined ALBA.
Yep.
And that was what triggered the coup. But anyway, in 2009. But anyway, and that's just an example. And President Seren, Salvador Sanchez Seren of El Salvador, has now taken this step. And why has he taken it? Because he gets nothing from the United States. The United States have nothing to offer their partners.
Right.
So, that is the importance of the ALBA Political Council meeting in Nicaragua. It took place on the 42nd anniversary of the death in combat of Comandante Carlos Fonseca Amador, the founder of the Frente Sandinista the Sandinista National Liberation Front here in Nicaragua. And the fact that they held the meeting on November the 8th was deliberate. They deliberately held it on that date because they wanted to celebrate the Nicaraguan government's defeat of the attempted coup earlier this year between April and July. They wanted to celebrate that. They wanted to affirm all their country's support for the Nicaraguan government, and they wanted to make a very strong statement of regional unity in the face of both United States attempts to recolonize Latin America and the Caribbean, and the advances in countries like Brazil of outright fascism, which you also see in Colombia under Duque, and the destruction of the peace agreement there. Just in case people don't know, the current members of the Bolivarian Alliance of the Americas are Cuba, Bolivia, Venezuela, Nicaragua, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Dominica. I'm not sure St. Kitts and Nevis. I'm not sure Santa Lucia. I'm not sure if Santa Lucia is in or out.
St. Lucia, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Venezuela, St. Kitts and Nevis, Nicaragua, Grenada, Dominica, Cuba, Bolivia, Antigua and Barbuda.
Yep. Right. Antigua and Barbuda. And so you have these Caribbean island nations who have benefited greatly both from Petrocaribe and ALBA. Prime Minister Ralph Gonsalves of St. Vincent and the Grenadines made a very strong speech at the meeting where the public assembly where they were honoring Carlos Fonseca together with the Nicaraguan authorities. And it was very interesting that Ralph Gonsalves reminded everybody that the Garifuna population of Central America, the Garifuna people are a people of West African descent who originally settled in St. Vincent. And when the British decided that they'd like to have St. Vincent for themselves, they committed the usual genocide that they did and drove out the black population of St. Vincent, who settled all along the Atlantic and Caribbean coast of Central America. So you find, and also I think also up in North America too. So you have Garifuna settlements on Honduras's northern coast, down. I think they're in. They have settlements in Belize. They have settlements on Nicaragua's Caribbean coast and also on Costa Rica's Caribbean coast. And it was just interesting that Ralph Gonsalves made the point that the Caribbean and the Central American countries, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, have a common history, and they have a common interest in standing together against efforts to dominate them and subjugate their resources and peoples to the needs of empire. It was just very interesting for Ralph Gonsalves, one of the leaders of the West Indian group of nations that in CARICOM, the Caribbean community, that he made that very strong statement as part of the ALBA meeting last week in Nicaragua. And another strong statement was made by Bolivia's foreign minister, who was at that meeting. And that was interesting because also last week, Bolivia held a meeting of UNASUR, or the countries that continue to participate in UNASUR. And Bolivia is also taking over from El Salvador, as it happens, the presidency of the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, which is the integration body that was set up really at the initiative of President Hugo Chavez, strongly supported by the Cuban leadership and, of course, by Daniel Ortega and his colleagues in Nicaragua. And so that CELAC is how the acronym is pronounced in Spanish. That body, which excludes the United States and Canada, even despite the current ascendancy in much of Latin America of right-wing governments, that remains extremely relevant because it's the only body that enables Latin America as a region, Latin America and the Caribbean as a region, to negotiate as a bloc with, say, the European Union or the People's Republic of China or the Russian Federation. So it remains extremely relevant despite attempts by individuals like Mauricio Macri and the elites that he represents in Argentina, and we're sure to find something similar happening with Jair Bolsonaro and the Brazilian elites. Perhaps we can talk a bit more about that if we've got time. But the CELAC remains extremely relevant even for the right-wing governments in the region, whereas UNASUR has gone through a crisis as a result of the rejection of its attempts to try and serve as a platform to mediate ideological differences between, in particular, between extreme right-wing regimes like Argentina's and the usurper government of Michel Temer in Brazil, Ivan Duque in Colombia, Sebastian Piñera in Chile. And these right-wing governments, they don't like the fact that the ALBA countries in UNASUR, in specifically Venezuela and Bolivia, are able to use UNASUR as a platform whereby they're able to demand that they be treated as equals with respect. The right-wing governments in the region much prefer to serve as the the lackeys of the United States in the Organization of American States and follow the U.S. agenda in the Organization of American States in political terms. But UNASUR remains relevant on the economic front in terms of economic integration.
Yeah.
And you can see that the importance of the fact that, for example, Peru is not going to abandon UNASUR. Peru is currently going through one of its periodic political crises with the former right-wing opposition leader who almost became president, Keiko Fujimori. She's now been sentenced to 30 months of preventive jail in relation to corruption charges.
Right.
But the government there still has a strong right-wing stance, but in terms of, this goes back to what we're talking about in terms of CELAC, Peru is very interested and very committed to working with Bolivia on regional integration initiatives like the Transcontinental Railroad financed by China. And it's fascinating to see how all these things interact.
This is the brainchild of Hugo Chavez in many ways. He was the one that said, you know, look, we don't need an ideological test to be your partner. You're here in the same region we are. We will defend your sovereignty. We will seek to move closer to you culturally, economically, in whatever ways are beneficial to each of us. And how you run your country is your business, and how we run our country is ours. It's like China with their win-win. It's an interesting looking past arguing over ideology towards materialism, really. Towards let's get the actual practical things functioning together and recognize where the real threat comes from and defend ourselves from that, and the rest will shake out.
Right. And you have this internal conflict in UNASUR between the countries of the so-called Pacific Alliance,
right,
which are Chile, Peru, Colombia, and Mexico.
Yeah, the TPP
Mexico on the 1st of December will be governed by Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who has taken a lot of criticism from the right wing in Mexico for inviting Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela, to his inauguration.
Yep.
But we're jumping away from where I really want to focus on at the moment, which is this what you were talking about, the economic imperative of who's doing the investment in infrastructure. Well, it's not the United States, right? It's China.
Right.
So the right-wing country like Peru, whom you'd expect to be more amenable to following what the United States wanted to do, clearly sees that its best interests lie in working with China and whoever the other partners are.
Right.
Because there's a bunch of European engineering companies that are interested in participating in the Transcontinental Railway project. But there's that happening. But there's also another right-wing government, Paraguay, run by under President Horacio Cartes, who's a really strong right-winger. And he may not be as fascist in the terms that Jair Bolsonaro is, who's going to take over the presidency in Brazil shortly, I think also in December. But Horacio Cartes and his administration are extremely right-wing, and they've just collaborated closely again with Bolivia to open up Bolivia's port system to the Atlantic.
Right.
Now, Bolivia... And that happened about a month ago, I think. So Bolivia now has a port system out to the Atlantic for the first time ever, you know?
Right.
And so you have Peru on the one hand collaborating with Bolivia and China on the Transcontinental Railway. You have Paraguay collaborating with Bolivia on a port system out to the Atlantic, and also Uruguay. So it's not, one has to be very careful about the assumptions that one makes in terms of what are going to be the practical outcomes of these, of this ideological configuration. Because just the mere fact that you have a right-wing government in Peru and a right-wing government in Paraguay would make you think, oh, well, they're going to ally with Chile and they're going to do what they can to stymie Bolivia's national development under a progressive government. You know, that's what you think, but that's not what has happened. And there are all kinds of reasons why it hasn't happened, but I don't know enough about to go into in a brief way.
Right.
But the thing about that is that what you had was look at these five things.
Okay, look at them in a minute and a half, because that's how much time we have left.
The president of Cuba goes to Asia. The ALBA countries hold their meeting in Managua. Bolivia holds a meeting of the UNASUR countries. President of El Salvador goes to China. Right. And the president-elect of Mexico throws off his critics and does what he thinks is the right thing, inviting President Maduro to his inauguration.
Mm-hmm.
And all that strongly offsets the depressing result in Brazil.
Yeah, I think so too. You know, the whole narrative of a conservative restoration, or be more counter-revolution, I think would be the proper political language. But all of that, it gives the lie to it, because the forward motion is obviously still there. It's a matter of struggle, because there's resistance being put up by the old order. But you can see that people are not going home and giving up, that's for sure. All right, so
they've got nowhere else to go but forward.
That's right. All right, so we got to stop there. Tony, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure as always. And we'll pick up where we left off next week, starting with what's happened with Cristina, the charges dropped against her in Argentina for lack of evidence.
Okay, look forward to it.
Me too. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Sherat-Natze. When war turns to peace, the greedy work of those in the shadows who are bringing the pieces together is often ignored, and officials take the credit. But not today. I talked to a French businessman who takes no glory in saving lives and ending conflict, Jean-Yves Olivier. Expert in parallel diplomacy, chairman of Brazzaville Foundation, is my guest today.
When international mediation, politicians and career diplomats fail to end conflict, other forces come into play. Working quietly as private citizens, out of the spotlight, grinding away at mistrust and blood feuds. Patiently bringing warring parties to the table. Why does parallel citizen diplomacy work where all the king's horses give up? Who are the people willing to work in the shadows without the promise of Nobel Peace Prizes or TV fame? And how do they get the job done?
Jean-Yves Olivier, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me with you today.
It's such an interesting profession. I want to know all about it. So you are a noted negotiator, lots of success stories in Africa. I know that you're now trying to get sites in Libya to sit down and talk. I mean, in a way, you're more successful than United Nations. At least you're getting these guys to sit down and talk.
I cannot say that I'm more successful than United Nations. I think we need United Nations, but also somewhere, somehow, I am needed also. It's a combination of two forces which are working parallel.
So you are right now talking about putting down the barriers of mistrust in Libya, but those barriers were actually put up way before you and for the reasons that are beyond you. What makes you think that an outsider can bring them down?
First of all, the knowledge of the country, and I know Libya since my first trip to Libya was in 1969. But also the respect for the tradition and the way the country lives. And going to one issue, which is while all institutions are fighting, where all countries are fighting over Libya, why not giving the Libyan the possibility to exert their voice and to jointly express what they would like to do with their own country? This is my aim. It's not to make peace, it's to create the fundamentals, to create the roots for a real and peace. This is what I'm trying to do.
So what kind of effort do you have to make to actually bring these people together in the same room?
Trust. Trust is always...
It's a big word.
Yes, it's a big word, but it's essential. What I have done for Libya, for example, is the following. I'll try to identify in the general scope of the political in Libya the two extremes of the scope. And I found Bashir Saleh, who was aides and very close to Gaddafi, and Abdelatif Belaj was who fought the Gaddafi regime since the age of 17. So, and those are the two extremes. They were the one who you will say they will never talk together because they really are one accusing the other of the worst things. And so I put them together.
How?
How? By convincing them that the meeting will be not to discuss the past and what is wrong, but to see what they have in common, what they want for Libya in common, what is their point of convergence as far as Libya is concerned, and ignoring their point of divergence, the point where they don't agree on. And it happened. Of course, they were extremely criticized by their own people or the people of their followers. How can you meet this man? How can you sit with Belaj? How can you sit with Bashir Saleh? But from that meeting, they agree on very simple principle about the future of Libya. They agree that it should be one country, that there should be a civilian government, that there should be an army who will respond to the civilian government, that there should be an independent judiciary.
Because this is something, that's what I'm saying, like this is something that international diplomats have been trying to do forever. And you're just saying, you know, I convinced both sides that they shouldn't talk about the past, just talk about the future and the common goal of Libya. This is a very simple, straightforward formula that other diplomats use as well. I still don't understand how it works out when you come in and it doesn't when other diplomats do. You must have a key that others don't. What is that thing?
I have a key. Number one, I have a past.
I mean, do you give them some kind of guarantees? What
is
it?
Of course not. There is no guarantee. They could have not even checked their hand at the beginning, or they could have left each other after 5 minutes. No. The problem is, once you are not an institution, when you are not a government, your voice is your voice. It belongs to you. And if there is trust in your voice, then people accept to do things they would not accept with institution. This is the difference between parallel diplomacy and the official diplomacy. The official diplomacy is one line. Everybody talks the same way. Nobody can have their individual opinion. They have to express what the general...
The official line says.
The official line. Me, I am not bound to that. I can do what I want when I want, and people believe, trust me. Just one example. In South Africa, I start the dialogues between white and black by an exchange of prisoners. 360 people. Five countries involved. The exchange took place in Maputo, in Mozambique. It happened very smoothly. Everything went right. Not one document was signed. There is not a paper which has been signed. Everybody arrived with their prisoners, with their planes to pick back the back of the prisoners. Everybody believes that they should arrive at that time and depart at that time. No paper. Not one paper. And that was involving major countries like France, Holland, South Africa, Namibia, Mozambique.
So I wonder if it always goes down so smooth. I had a friend, an American friend, who was working at the fall of apartheid in South Africa, just like you. And he was telling me, you know, every time he's in the conflict resolution as well. And he was telling me, you know, every time I go for a new job, I have this feeling that I know what to do. I know how to fix it. I know it better. And after 3 years of being there, he's like, you just fall into this state where you understand you don't know anything. And you probably will never understand anything. Do you ever get that feeling when you go to a new conflict, to a new country, where you feel like, I know it, I'm going to do this. And then you're on the ground and you're trying to do your job, trying. And then at the end of the day, you're like, I just don't understand anything and probably never will.
You were talking about success. Thanks God, I had some success. But I had also failure. I had big failure. I tried to fix other conflicts, which I didn't succeed. So, of course, I am promoting my success. But why? It's to give a chance to peace. To give a chance to peace doesn't mean that you guarantee that you will bring peace. But at least you give a chance to achieve peace. This is what I'm only trying to do. With no guarantee that I will succeed. So I am much more courageous and much more ambitious than if I am thinking whether I'm going to succeed or not. This is not my issue. I am not thinking whether, what are the chances, what are the statistics, what are the possibilities for me to succeed. I am not interested. I just say, do I have enough elements in my hands to try to bring peace? Do I have these elements here? And am I going to put them aside and not doing what I want? No, of course not. I go for it.
Is there a slight danger at any point in your line of work where you feel like sense of superiority? Here I am, white man from the land of prosperity and peace. I come to you, petty squabblers. I will solve your pain because I know better. Do you ever get that feeling? Because it's dangerous. There's a fine line when you have so much power and trust in your hands and you can make the processes move. You can get that sense.
You can?
Yeah.
Sure. I don't.
You don't?
I am the very, as I don't believe that I am sure of what I'm doing, that I am, as I am a person who hesitant, I don't know the word in English, I'm sorry. As I doubt about what I am doing. The sense, the feeling of superiority can never occur, because if I doubt, that means that I don't have a sense of superiority. And I never go with a sense of, and people know that. You know, we are dealing with men. We are dealing with human. And sometimes we have to put aside the paper and the document and the report and the explanation, the logical explanations. To get also the human side in the peace, because everybody wants peace. The people who are the most warrior, who appear to be the most warrior characters, they, somehow they're hoping for peace. They want peace. Peace is there, is inherent of your body.
I think maybe something even worse than sense of superiority that a lot of big powers get while they're going into conflicts is ignorance. Because right now we see a lot of politicians, they don't have the understanding of the region when they actually act in that region. They don't know the complexity, the fragility of the places that they affect. For instance, I remember President Obama saying that not the lack of planning in Libya was probably one of his biggest mistakes of his presidency. Just recently, Norway admitted having no idea what they were doing when they sent their planes to bomb Libya. And we see that happening actually a lot. Where does this amateur approach come from? I mean, should the elected leaders be sent to some mandatory geography political lessons about the world? Because this happens all the time.
You know, when you start to do something, and it's valid for government or individuals, don't think twice before you eliminate the bad and you replace it by the worse. And this is unfortunately what's happened more and more in the planet Earth. You want to take off the bad, but you replace it by something worse than the bad you have taken off. And for me, of course, how can you avoid that? You avoid it by reconciliations. This is because when you leave a conflict by creating another conflict, when you solve a solution by creating another difficulties, you fail. But when you deal with reconciliation, when the reconciliation is sincere, that the party really wants to build a future together, then you are avoiding to go from bad to worse.
Mr. Olivier, we're going to take a short break right now. When we come back, we'll continue talking about parallel diplomacy. What is it? And is it more effective than the official diplomacy? Stay with us.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And we're back with Jean-Yves Olivier, expert in parallel diplomacy and the chairman of the Brazzaville Foundation. Mr. Olivier, I remember you expressing your opinion in the early times of the Syrian conflict escalation. You wrote about wars of good versus evil. That was you, right? And you said that this is led by U.S. and they can log a force on everyone because balance of power is shifting. So I always think of why does the United States still go over and over again for the same strategy of fighting the black and white, good versus evil wars when it has brought obviously so much misery to the world and to themselves in the first place? Why?
It's not to me to answer to these questions.
I see you're a true diplomat.
No, I'm not. This is not to me. So why should I express an opinion on
but
Russia,
you have already.
On America? No, I am telling
you
that
I am just good versus evil wars.
Yes, I am just saying we have to be very worried that we by taking something bad we're replacing by something even worse, and history has proven that some of the actions taken by this one or this one have been replacing something bad by something even worse. We leave that. The 20th century end up with this, with those mistakes. Because why? As you said about President Obama, they were not real planning after. What do we do after? How? And for me, I am taking this after as a very fundamental base. And after has to be reconciliation. If there is reconciliation, there can be exchange of opinion, there can be democracy at large. I'm not talking about Western democracy or Eastern democracy or specific democracy. I'm talking about the ability of the people to decide of their own future. And that can only be done if reconciliations occur and is real.
So you just mentioned earlier in the interview that parallel diplomacy and official diplomacy, it's parallel because they go without crossing paths. So that means that you're not part of the system, right? The official system, the establishment, when you do your job as a diplomat. But a lot of your success stories in the African period, they were tied to Mitterrand, they were tied to Chirac. So you kind of are in the system, or are you completely not part of the system?
At a certain moment, it's time for the system to take over. That's for sure. I am, as I said earlier, I am not here to make peace. I am here to facilitate peace. Who is going to make peace is the institution, because you need treaty, agreement, and so on, which I am not capable to take. So yes, at a certain moment, there is, let's say, if some people accept it, some countries accept it, there is a lack of communication and a takeover by those countries of to bring everything to the finality. When I did the Brazzaville Accord, which led to the independence of Namibia, And for the first time, the Cuban and the American were sitting at the same table with, together with the South African and the Angolan. Once I have, so the protocol has been signed, it was taken by the UN, and there was a big show in the UN for the signing of the agreement. I was not even invited. I was not invited. Nobody invited me when they all know that I was, I initiate these things. Because it's time at a certain moment that the official part take over. And I don't pretend that I can replace what is official. Of course not. I am not here to replace anybody. I am not here I am here to help, to assist, not to replace.
Do the official diplomats listen to your advice as an outsider, or do they really try to shut you down because it's competition?
Then we go back to the human nature. I have extraordinary friends which are diplomats, and they understand what I do and they approve what I do. Of course, whether the system they belong to has the same feeling regarding myself? Probably not. But then again, it's not white and black. It's, I have very good friends who are diplomats. And I have no problem with them because they realize that I bring something extra to their official diplomacy. But of course, there are institutions who don't like me. Maybe they don't like successes.
Have your political convictions or, I don't know, moral convictions ever get in the way of doing the job as a, in parallel diplomacy? For instance, this guy, I cannot talk to. That one, I'll talk to. Or whatever you feel personally is always irrelevant if you have to make peace and make people reconcile.
There is not one person in the planet Earth I would refuse to talk with. Never one. As criminal can be, I will accept, if he is ready to talk about peace, I will talk to him, of course.
So in the beginning of the interview, you said that I bring fighting sides to one table because there is trust. You know, they trust me and they trust that, you know, if they come together, it's going to be for the better of the common cause. Does this always work? How do you make people who are not willing to reconcile change their mind? Or does this only work when they actually do want to negotiate deep inside?
You see, this is a tactic between records. When I did the first conference, which is in May in Dakar, which is called now Dakar 1, because hopefully we are going to have a Dakar 2. I didn't invite all the people there. I didn't know all the people who were there. What I have done is I went to Béchir Saleh, I went to Abdelatif Belhadj, and I said, please convince your friends to come to the conference. So it's them who have been convincing their friends to come to the conference. So I was not exposed as a person. The trust was jumping from one person to the other. But at the end of the day, they were all there. Because if I would have been the one who had been traveling with my luggage and going to see the people I want to invite, I convinced, maybe I would not have succeeded. Because they don't know me. They never saw me. Who was this white man in the Libyan conflict, as you earlier said? But if I am using somebody who is known by them, that's a different approach. This is something which is, you know, very briefly, when I started to be interested in Africa, I had the chance, I was very young, I was 20, I was invited for dinner by a very fantastic man, president of Côte d'Ivoire, of Ivory Coast, called Oufred Boigny. And he invited me for lunch and he was listening to me and I was enthusiastic and I told him what I want to do in Africa and how Africa was there. And at the end of the dinner, he said, you are interested with Africa, I am going to give you only one advice, only one. Never enter an African village if you are not accompanied by somebody who is known by the village. And I have applied this rule all my life. Is the guarantee, the caution is not at the beginning, is never given by myself, it's given by somebody who has the trust of the person I am meeting. And it works.
So I realize that there are no guarantees of any kind of anything when you get to people, when you get people in the same room that have been killing each other for such a long time. It's always a big deal that they sit down. But what is the success rate usually? Those people who have been feuding for so long, okay, they're in the same room. What is the success rate after they start talking? Have you, I'm sure you've...
Okay, there is no statistic, sorry, I cannot...
But in your personal experiences.
I don't count, okay? But let me tell you something. Is where dialogue is the most essential thing. Because that means if they have accepted to meet, it has been a preparation with their meeting. It's not they meet with no idea of what they are going to discuss or prepare. So indirectly, the dialogue has been established between them. Probably most of the time for me. So they have, before they meet, they have evaluated, appreciated the risk that it is going to be very bitter or very sour and they will leave. But I never experienced a moment where I put two parties together and one has left the room. Never experimented. They might not enter the room. It did happen in Dakar 1 when the Haftar messengers, delegates, accepted to be on the plane of charter, arrived in Dakar, but when they saw who was going to be in the room, they said, no, we cannot sit there with the same people, and they left. So, but that the possible the way that they leave the room, I never experimented that.
But do you know, like, gestures, words that already like signal to you that, there's going to be a deal here? Do you feel in advance?
Of course.
What are these, like, gestures?
Yes, then you have to encourage. That is where you intervene. You know, your neutrality remains as long as there is not a beginning or a slight of a conflictual positions. Then, yes, you have the right to intervene and calm down and tell the people, but this is what he mean, this is what the other one's in. At the end of the day, maybe you can match. And this is, you feel it. You, in negotiation, you feel at the time you should intervene, yes.
Would you work on a complicated conflict like Syria? And if not, then what would you advise people to do there?
No, I will never work on the conflict like Syria because, unfortunately, Syria has gone beyond the people of Syria. I still believe that in Libya, it has not yet reached a level where it goes beyond the people of Libya. In Syria, it has gone beyond the people of Syria. The people of Syria today doesn't count. I mean, what will be my role? To have the Syrian government matching, meeting,
Free Syrian Army.
The US government? No, this is not my role. And I don't have the keys I cannot, in those cases, I give up. I'm not following those things.
Well, good luck in the cases that you are involved, and I'm sure they're going to be successful, like most of the cases you have undertaken. Thank you very much for this interview.
Thank you very, very much.
It's been a pleasure.
It has been a pleasure for me too.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.